From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, calls for the resignation of the Veterans Affairs Secretary grow louder in the wake of a devastating new report.
Each day in the news, there's a constant drone calling for the head of Secretary Shinseki. Cutting off the head of a problem is not the answer. The VA is comparable to the monster legend, the Hydra. We can chop off one head after another only to find that two more grow back in their place.
Also today, the US economy slumps for the first time in 3 years. We ask if the recovery is over. And we're in Pakistan, where the deadly public stoning of a pregnant woman draws global condemnation.
Honor killings normally happen in private, you know, in the family home. They are very rarely ever registered with the police. There are more than 1,000 each year.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Armed pro-Russia rebels have shot down a Ukrainian helicopter in the eastern city of Slavyansk, killing at least 11 people, including a general. Outgoing Ukrainian President Alexander Turchynov says the militants used a Russia-made anti-aircraft missile to take down the helicopter. Slavyansk has been at the center of fighting between Ukrainian government forces and pro-Russian militants in recent weeks. Ukrainian President-elect Petro Poroshenko has promised to ramp up Kiev's response to these bandits and murderers. Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has vowed to wipe out Boko Haram and extremist insurgents in the northeastern part of the country. The president made the remarks in a speech marking Democracy Day in Nigeria. He said his government will find and bring the schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram back safely. FSN's Gary Alfonso reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The Nigerian president's promise to crush Boko Haram follows a week in which his government has faced increased pressure to find the abducted girls. He said he's deployed 1,000 more troops to the troubled northeast of the country, where insurgents attack and kill rural villagers and security forces with impunity. But Nigeria's defense chief has also been criticized for prematurely claiming that the military knew where the kidnapped girls were being kept. U.S. special forces will apparently start flying surveillance drones over the dense forests in the region in the next few days. That, combined with a seemingly greater political will from the Nigerian authorities, may finally yield results in the quest to free the almost 230 girls stolen almost 7 weeks ago.
Pakistan's prime minister has called for an investigation into the public murder of a pregnant woman stoned to death by members of her own family. It's believed the 25-year-old victim was set upon because she'd married a man her relatives disapproved of. So-called honor killings are common in Pakistan, with hundreds reported each year. The U.S. Commerce Department has released data showing the GDP shrinking at a 1% annual rate. It's the first time the economy has shrunk in its first quarter since 2011. Patrice Howard reports from New York.
The data is a revision of the Commerce Department's initial estimate, which showed a slight gain for the period. The downward tick was driven by reduced additions to inventories by businesses and a weaker-than-expected trade balance. Severe weather in the first quarter of 2014 disrupted business as usual. Consumer spending on food services and accommodations fell for the first time in 4 years. Exports and investment also subtracted from growth. It's the first quarter in 3 years in which the nation's output of goods and services has declined, but economists expect a rise of 3-4% in the second quarter.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A Sudanese woman sentenced to death earlier this month after refusing to renounce her Christian faith has given birth to a baby girl in prison. And the U.S. State Department is now under heavy fire from her husband, who has U.S. citizenship, over failing to intervene on her behalf. Nina Maria Potts reports from Washington.
Miriam Ibrahim was condemned to death earlier this month after she was convicted for abandoning her religious faith. She was given 4 days to repent and escape death, but the deadline passed without her changing her mind. She was also sentenced to 100 lashes for having a relationship with a non-Muslim. Her husband, from South Sudan and a U.S. citizen, has accused the State Department of not doing enough to intervene. But spokeswoman Jen Psaki says their hands are tied pending DNA testing of their toddler son to prove the boy is his.
We can't speak to the specifics of the case because we don't have a Privacy Act waiver, but I would say, broadly speaking, There needs to be proof of that genetic connection in order to have the rights of an American citizen for anyone.
Maryam Ibrahim has given birth now to a baby girl in jail, while calls continue to mount on U.S. President Barack Obama to intervene.
And the search for missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 appears to be back to square one, with the search off Australia's west coast being called off. Arthur Stevens has more from Melbourne.
Search coordinators have confirmed the search for MH370 is now complete, with Australia's Transport Safety Bureau saying the area can be discounted as the plane's final resting place. The statement from the Joint Agency Coordination Centre comes hours after CNN reported US Navy Deputy Director of Ocean Engineering Michael Dean as saying the pings came from some other man-made source unrelated to MH370.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A growing list of officials and veterans advocates are calling for the resignation of Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseki. This follows an investigation that found at least one government hospital kept veterans waiting up to 115 days to see a doctor and fudged the records to hide those delays. In Washington, D.C., our correspondent Alice Olstein reports that many want more than Shinseki stepping down and are calling for President Obama to take responsibility for an overhaul of the entire veteran healthcare system.
Following the publication this week of a government watchdog report detailing mismanagement and possible criminal wrongdoing at a veterans hospital in Arizona, Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill are calling for the ouster of the head of the Department of Veterans Affairs. At a press conference in his home state, Arizona Republican and Vietnam veteran John McCain outlined what steps he thinks would bring accountability.
I believe that this issue has reached a level that requires the Justice Department involvement. These allegations are not just administrative problems. These are criminal problems. We need the FBI and the Department of Justice to be involved in this investigation. I also, with some reluctance, believe that it's given the lack of responsiveness of Secretary Shinseki to numerous inquiries from Senator Flake and me, that it's time for Secretary Shinseki to step down. And if Secretary Shinseki does not step down voluntarily, then I call on the President of the United States to relieve him of his duties.
The report found that at least 1,700 veterans in Phoenix, Arizona, were put on an unofficial waiting list at the hospital, and some were made to wait an average of 115 days for an appointment, while others may never have received care. The hospital used this secret waitlist to make it appear as if they were meeting their goal of seeing patients within 14 days, and the false data was then used to determine bonuses for VA officials. The inspector general also said his office received numerous allegations of mismanagement, inappropriate hiring decisions, sexual harassment, and bullying. The investigation has now been expanded to cover 42 veterans hospitals around the country, and a final report is expected in August. With evidence of such systemic problems, many officials, including Virginia Republican Eric Cantor, are questioning whether Secretary Shinseki's resignation will solve or change anything.
We must remember, this is about more than one man. This is about millions of veterans, and they deserve more accountability than one resignation.
But some of his colleagues, including Florida Republican Jeff Miller, who chairs the House Veterans Affairs Committee, disagrees.
You know what? It matters. It sends a clear signal. Part of the problem at VA is they do that very same thing. They will tell you, well, we can't get rid of this person because we don't know who they're going to... Look, if they can't do the job, they got to go.
Near midnight on Wednesday, the House of Representatives passed a bill to provide an additional $1 million in funding for a Justice Department investigation of the alleged mismanagement. On Thursday, the leaders of several veterans groups called on the Senate to take up and pass the measure. Tal Coley, an Air Force veteran with the Concerned Veterans for America, said the bill would be a crucial first step for those around the country languishing without care.
Just like the sales manager that I met yesterday, an Army vet who served our country for 12 years and has been waiting 5 months so far to be seen in a Maryland VA clinic.
The Inspector General's report did not address allegations that as many 40 veterans have died waiting for care. They said they still need to examine autopsy reports and other documents, and say they've so far found no indication that any of the deaths were tied to the appointment delays. Alice Olstein, Washington.
This is FSN Reports. It was a bad day for the US economy, with officials announcing the nation's GDP had shrunk by 1% in the first quarter of 2014. The drop, the first in 3 years, has been pinned to the impact of harsh nationwide winter conditions. For more on the figures, I spoke to Heidi Moore, The Guardian's US finance and economics editor, and began by asking her if this meant the recovery was over.
It doesn't quite yet. These numbers are revised pretty frequently, and so the first batch of numbers for gross domestic product came out in early May. This is the second revision. We're going to have two more revisions, so we won't really know until the end of July, if you can believe it, what the real number is. But this revision is so sharply downward that it does give pause to what had been the prevailing narrative about the economy, which is that it is growing and recovering. And a contraction is pretty dangerous, because when the economy contracts, even by a little bit, it sets the stage for people to start thinking about whether we're in another recession. And that is such a huge contradiction to what we've believed has been happening that it has to be taken seriously.
So that explains today's results. But what about the rest of the year? Is there more bad news on the horizon?
Right now in the U.S., housing is weak. And employment is not very strong either. And those are two major aspects of consumer demand. So there's one strain of thought that says, well, if it's dropping now, of course it's going to keep dropping. Then there's another strain of thought that says this was only an inventory problem. It means good things, because at least if all of that is cleared up now, then the second half of the year can grow pretty robustly. And there are some really optimistic estimates of how fast the economy can grow in the second half of the year. In fact, Goldman Sachs is predicting it can grow 3.5%, which is huge. And so there are a lot of optimists out there. And right now it's a matter of interpretation, who you believe and what economic measures you emphasize.
So if those lofty predictions were to come about, what would the Federal Reserve's reaction be, do you think?
I think it would be shocked, primarily, because if you look at the recent Federal Reserve discussions, they have been pretty nervous about economic growth and housing growth. And so if we had a huge amount of economic growth, I think they'd be pretty surprised. It probably wouldn't affect policy on things like interest rates, because they want to see, you know, a few quarters or maybe even a year of evidence before they make any big decisions.
Heidi Moore, The Guardian's US finance and economics editor. Total war, the Nigerian president's threat to extremist group Boko Haram as the country prepares for a full-scale offensive against the Islamists. Goodluck Jonathan made the announcement 2 months after hundreds of schoolgirls were abducted in the east of the country and during a time when Boko Haram's terror campaign has intensified. He spoke just one day after President Obama singled out the Nigerian extremists in his U.S. foreign policy speech.
Tragically, no American security operation can eradicate the threat posed by an extremist group like Boko Haram, the group that kidnapped those girls. And that's why we have to focus not just on rescuing those girls right away, but also on supporting Nigerian efforts to educate its youth.
FSN's Africa correspondent Gary Alfonso spoke to me earlier.
Well, today is Democracy Day in Nigeria, and the president used the opportunity, the platform, to highlight that in a democratic country, the authorities are going to do everything within their power to try and stop this Boko Haram threat, the extremist Islamic threat in the northeast of the country, and Borno State specifically, where these insurgents have been trying to implant a Sharia law state that borders obviously with Chad and Niger and Northern Cameroon, and have basically been holding people to ransom there for many, many months, and even some years with small attacks in recent years. But saying now that the Nigerian authorities are giving this the priority it requires, and that they're basically going to go all out to try and completely eradicate it and destroy it, and that's the strongest yet message or word from the government and the president of the country on that exact issue.
The United States has taken an active role in the hunt for these missing girls, but you also had President Obama yesterday saying that the United States couldn't solve the problem of Boko Haram and that it should play a supporting role for the Nigerian government in their fight against these extremists. So with that in mind, what military action is underway right now in the country to get these girls back and crush this insurgency?
Well, the interesting point is that everybody agrees that Boko Haram and these insurgents actually have the upper hand in northeastern Nigeria. They literally attack small villages and small military installations and military personnel with impunity and kill at random at roadblocks. They're very fast, they're very quick on 4x4 vehicles, multi-terrain vehicles, motorbikes, and basically move in very quickly. And the kind of military might needed to suppress this is maybe anybody's guess, but ultimately it will require a multi-pronged approach, and not just the small military checkpoints that have been in those parts of Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria, for the past few months and years. So putting 1,000 more troops into that area might not do the trick completely, but we also understand that over the next few days the U.S. surveillance drones will be sent into that area. U.S. Special Forces have already deployed from Abuja towards Maguduri in the northeast of the country, and therewith I think comes the pledge from the U.S. president that Boko Haram might just be one of the Islamic extremist groups on the planet and doing very much damage here in Africa, and with this high profile case of the abduction of these girls. But it literally means that these kinds of organizations can very, very quickly deploy and grow their numbers, because they can be seen as being formidable opponents, and obviously also crushing very, very legitimate educational and social structures in society in getting their way. So very much on that message, I think Goodluck Jonathan then also saying that with the help of foreign forces, these Boko Haram insurgents and other small vigilante groups that work with them will be crushed, and hopefully perhaps destroy that level of terrorism on society in northeastern Nigeria.
FSN's Gary Alfonso in Nigeria. Pakistan's Prime Minister has called for an investigation into the public murder of a pregnant woman stoned to death by members of her own family. It's believed the 25-year-old victim was set upon because she'd married a man her relatives disapproved of. So-called honour killings are common in Pakistan, with hundreds reported each year. For more on the story, I spoke to Islamabad-based journalist Annabel Symington.
A newly married young bride called Fazana Paveen, who's 25, was killed on Tuesday by her family outside the Lahore High Court. She was stoned to death by a mob of over 20, which included cousins, brothers and her father. She had actually gone to the court in order to record a statement in front of a judge stating that she had married this man, Mohammed Iqbal, for love, out of choice. Whereas her father had claimed that this man had kidnapped his daughter. Now, this is sort of quite common when love marriages happen in Pakistan. So a marriage that's against the sort of father's or family's wishes, often the father will end up registering a kidnapping allegation against the husband. This case has now been termed an honor killing, which is when a family seeks to restore what they see as lost honor by killing a girl. And honor, family honor, is very, very tied up with the girl's purity. And if she defies her family, as has happened in this case, or so the family see, the only way to restore the honour of the family is to murder the girl.
The graphic and public nature of this young woman's death has also seen Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif get involved. What's happened there and how significant is that?
So Nawaz Sharif finally got involved today. So that's 2 days after the attack. He finally released a statement saying that a full investigation needs to happen and he expects answers by tonight. The fact that it's taken him 2 days has angered some members of civil society here. But at the same time, for the Prime Minister to take note of an honour killing is extraordinary. Honour killings normally happen in private, in the family home. They are very rarely ever registered with the police. While the Pakistan Commission for Human Rights estimates that there are more than 1,000 each year, those figures are purely based on registered cases, so the cases that have either made it into the media or to the police. The figure is, in fact, probably much, much higher. Mm. So it is certainly significant that the Prime Minister has decided to take note of this particular case, and hopefully we will actually, in this case, see the law take some action and potentially prosecute the people involved.
Human rights organisations, women's rights organisations, they do suggest that violence against the female population there is certainly on the increase.
Yes, absolutely. Certainly talking to people over the last few days, a lot of women's rights activists and human rights activists have commented that while laws are in place to protect women, and in many ways Pakistan actually has pretty exemplary laws in that regard, their implementation is absolutely appalling, next to nil. In the rural areas, police will often turn a blind eye to cases like honour killings because they just view it as a family matter. And certainly in this instance, the family is considered as a fairly influential family. So in the rural areas, you've sort of got this very entrenched tribal system whereby, you know, an influential family is very much viewed and considered as being above the law. So, you know, the police will just sort of turn a blind eye. But it is certainly surprising that a case took place in, an honour killing did take place in Lahore, which is the second largest city in Pakistan. It's also commonly described as the cultural hub of Pakistan, where, you know, you've got a thriving art scene and a Lahore and an elite who, you know, a very westernised elite. So to see this kind of thing happening in that city is extraordinary.
Islamabad-based journalist Annabel Symington. And finally, tonight, FSN Spotlight, the segment of the show that covers a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the state of women's rights in Saudi Arabia. Earlier this week, a prominent cleric there decreed that online conversations and web chats between men and women are religiously forbidden and may lead to acts of sin. Sheikh Abdullah Al-Mutlaq, a member of the Saudi Committee of Senior Scholars, urged women not to use social media to converse with men, a view that many Saudis took to social media to ridicule. So what is the state of women's rights in the kingdom today? Sarah Burke, Middle East correspondent for The Economist, recently visited Riyadh and she spoke with the newspaper's Leila Malana Allen.
I mean, one thing that's starting to change is you're seeing more women in public. That was something that a few years ago, people who lived in Saudi Arabia, including some long-term expats, said they perhaps never even talked to a woman in Saudi Arabia. So you are seeing them on the streets, in cafes, sometimes with other women rather than always accompanied by men. The most obvious change at the moment, though, is in terms of work. So previously, Saudi women were only really allowed to work in education as teachers and university lecturers. Now, after a series of liberalizations, mainly last year, women can now work everywhere, from banks to cash tills in supermarkets, and even the first woman has set up a law firm earlier this year, whereas before, female lawyers were not actually allowed to practice once they'd graduated. For the first time, there are now 30 women in the Shura Council, which is a fairly weak consultative body for laws. They're also allowed from 2015 to run and vote in municipal council elections. And again, those councils are quite weak and don't have very much power, but at least they're becoming more visible and their voice will be there, even if it doesn't have any direct impact on legislation. Education is another area where there is continual progress. There are more women in higher education now than men. So that's definitely an area where there are changes.
And what do you think is behind these changes?
So I asked lots of women about this. Some of them said they think it's mainly social media, that they were speaking out before, but now their voice is really heard. You know, the government can't control what's written on social media. Everyone's discussing everything, and it's very hard to turn that off. Some women are just doing things that they, you know, they're fed up of not being able to drive. They can't get from A to B, and they're just getting in the car and doing it. And it's not just women trying to drive change. There are lots of men who are also doing it. Lots of men told me that the restrictions on women really affect their lives. They might have to get up and drive their daughters and wife to work or to school before they themselves go to work. And again, when they finish work, they have to go and pick them up again. So they're wasting hours of their time. Another big change is that the price of everything in Saudi Arabia is rising. And so economics is a big factor. There's lots of women I talked to who said they were only allowed to work because their husbands or their fathers were extremely grateful for the extra money coming into the household. So the economics is really changing things.
So what kind of action are women taking to try and make change happen?
Mainly it's by speaking out, especially on social media, or by doing things such as creating television shows. For example, YouTube is huge in Saudi Arabia. There are more Twitter users per internet user in Saudi Arabia than anywhere else. So women are doing all sorts of things. They're writing books, for example. Girls of Riyadh is a recent bestseller and was written by a woman. Wajda is a recent Saudi film, and it was all filmed in secret because there are no cinemas in Saudi Arabia. They're banned. And that, again, was directed by women and was about women as well in Saudi Arabia. So they're doing all sorts of things that are very, very proactive.
And what kind of recriminations can women face for breaking the rules?
A lot of Saudi legislation isn't actually written. The constitution is the Quran, and lots of the customs, such as not being able to drive, aren't actually legal. They're just customs that everyone accepts, and there'll be a punishment if they're violated. When women are caught driving, sometimes they're sentenced to a few months in prison, sometimes they're sentenced to lashes, often their car is taken away from them. Social censorship is another issue. Some women who are trying to push barriers and change things face criticism from men and from other women about their methods of trying to do that.
How uniform attitudes to how women should behave?
There's definitely a variation among women about what they do and don't think their position in society should be. One thing that was quite noticeable talking to all of them is that they don't want to emulate what women do in the West. There's definitely a sense that Saudi Arabia is the home of Islam, that it was where the Prophet was born, it was where Islam started, and Islam is very important to their identity as women. So it's about a discussion as to what Islam actually says about women, rather than being told by the male clergy.
Do you think these changes will last, and will there be more?
All the women I talk to are very positive about the future. They say that there's no way now that things can't change. What they argue about is how fast it should move. Lots of women say that they think it's easier to push changes just by getting on with things, by people seeing that the society doesn't fall apart if they drive, doesn't fall apart if they work. Others want to push it a bit further by doing things that are quite provocative. But obviously, all these changes are done in a way that doesn't directly challenge the basis of why this is enforced. And it's very difficult because the Wahhabi clergy who are pushing these ideas are very much a root of the whole system in Saudi Arabia. But a lot of women say there does need to be a debate as to what Islam actually does say about women, and the fact that many of the customs in Saudi Arabia don't come from Islam but come from conservative tribal norms or just men wanting to keep control of women and the society more generally. So until that debate happens, it's quite hard to see women attaining the full rights that they deserve.
That's Sarah Burke, Middle East correspondent for The Economist. You can read her reporting each week in the newspaper and online at economist.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Friday, South Sudan's struggle with the interwoven problems of conflict and the impending threat of famine. That's Friday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.